politics, that was. I went over to Carson City last November with Collie and Dick, and we bought it at a DEA auction, that very car. I had my head under the hood before we bid on her and drove her halfway home at speeds varying from 65 to 110. I recognize her all right. It's Arn. And as David turned to look at the old man, the still, small voice, the one he had first heard in Brian's hospital room, spoke to him. As usual, its arrival came pretty much as a surprise, and the two words it spoke made no immediate sense. The soap. He heard the words as clearly as he had heard, "You're praying already," while he had been sitting in the Viet Cong lookout with his eyes closed. The soap. He looked into the left rear corner of the cell he was sharing with old Mr. Whitehair. There was a toilet with no seat. Beside it was an ancient, rust-stained porcelain sink. Sitting beside the right-hand spigot was a green bar of what could only be Irish spring soap. Outside, the engine sound of the desperation police cruiser grew fatter and closer. A little farther off, the coyotes howled. To David, that howling had begun to sound like the laughter of lunatics after the keepers have decamped the asylum. 4. The Carver family had been too distraught and too focused on their captor to notice the dead dog hung from the Welcome to Town sign, but John Merrinville was a trained noticer, and in truth, the dog was now hard to miss. Since the Carvers had passed this way, the buzzards had found it. They sat on the ground below the carcass, the ugliest birds Johnny had ever seen, one pulling on old Shep's tail, the other gnawing at one of his dangling feet. The body swung back and forth on the rope twisted around its neck. Johnny made a sound of disgust. "Buzzards," the cop said. "Gosh, aren't they something?" His voice had thickened a great deal. He had sneezed twice more on the ride in from town, and the second time there had been teeth in the blood he sprayed out of his mouth. Johnny didn't know what was happening to him and didn't care. He only wished it would hurry up. "I'll tell you something about buzzards," the cop continued. "They wake to sleep and take their waking slow. They learn by going where they have to go. Wouldn't you agree, mon capitan?" A lunatic cop who quoted poetry, how sart. "Whatever you say, officer." He had no intention of antagonizing the cop again if he could help it. The guy seemed to be self-destructing, and Johnny wanted to be around when the process was over. They rolled past the dead dog and the grisly, skin-looking things dining on it. "What about the coyotes, Johnny? What was up with them?" But he wouldn't let himself think about the coyotes, lined up along both sides of the road at neat intervals like an honor guard, or of how they had peeled off like the Blue Angels as soon as the cruiser passed, running back into the desert as if their heads were on fire and their asses were catching. "They fart, you know," the cop said in his blood-soaked voice. "Buzzards fart."
"No, I didn't know that."
"Yes, sir. Only birds that do. I tell you so you can put it in your book. Chapter 16 of Travels with Harley."
Johnny thought the putative title of his book had never sounded so quintessentially stupid. They were now passing a trailer park. Johnny saw a sign in front of one rusty, roof-sagging double-wide which read, "I'm a gun-totin', snapple-drinkin', Bible-readin', Clinton-bashin' son of a bitch. Never mind the dog, beware of the owner." Welcome to country music hell, Johnny thought. The cruiser rolled past a mining company building. There were quite a few cars and pickups in the parking lot, which struck Johnny as peculiar. It was past quitting time now, and not by a little. Why weren't these cars in their own driveways, or down in front of the local watering hole?
"Yep, yep," the cop said. He lifted one hand as if to frame a picture. "I can see it now. Chapter 16, The Farting Buzzards of Desperation. Sounds like a goddamn Edgar Rice Burroughs novel, doesn't it? Burroughs was a better writer than you, though, and do you know why? Because he was a hack without pretensions, one with priorities. Tell the story, do the work, give the people something they can enjoy without feeling too stupid, and stay out of the gossip columns. Where are you taking me? Johnny asked, striving for a neutral tone. Jail, the big cop said in his stuffy, liquid voice, where anything you bray will be abused against you in a sort of caw. He leaned forward, wincing at the pain in his back where the cop had kicked him. You need help, he said. He tried to keep his voice non-accusatory, even gentle. Do you know that, officer? You're the one who needs help, the cop replied. Spiritual, physical, and editorial. Tack! But no help is going to come, Big John. You've eaten your last literary lunch and fucked your last culture cunt. You're on your own in the wilderness, and this is going to be the longest 40 days and 40 nights of your entire useless life. The words rang in his head like the peal of some sickly bell. Johnny closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them again. They were in the town proper now, passing Gale's Beauty Bar on one side and True Value Hardware on the other. There was nobody on the sidewalks. Absolutely nobody. He'd never seen a small western town that was actually bustling, but this was ridiculous. No one at all? As they passed the Conoco station, he saw a guy in the office, rocked back in his chair with his feet up on the desk, but that was it. Except, up ahead, a pair of animals went trotting lazily across what appeared to be the town's only intersection, moving on a diagonal beneath the blinker light. Johnny tried to tell himself they were dogs, but they weren't dogs. They were coyotes. It's not all the cop, Johnny. Don't you think it is? Something not normal is going on here. Something very much not normal. As they reached the intersection, the cop slammed on the brakes. Johnny, not expecting it, was thrown forward into the mesh between the front and back seats. He hit his nose and bellowed with surprised pain. The cop took no notice of him. "Billy Rancourt," he cried, delighted. "Damn, that's Billy Rancourt. I wondered where he got off to. Drunk in the basement of the Broken Drum. I bet you that's where he was. Dollars to donuts. Big balls, Billy. Damn if it's not." "My nose," Johnny cried. It had started bleeding again, and he once more sounded like a human foghorn. "Oh, Christ, it hurts." "Shut up, you baby," the cop said. "Gosh, aren't you spleeny?" He backed up a little, then turned the cruiser so it was facing west on the cross street. He cranked his window down and poked his head out. The nape of his neck was now the color of age-darkened bricks, badly blistered, crisscrossed with cracks. Bright lines of blood filled some of these. "Billy!" the cop yelled. "Yo, you Billy Rancourt! Hey, you old cuss!" The western end of Desperation appeared to be a residential section, dusty and dispirited, but maybe a cut or two above the trailer park. Through his watering eyes, Johnny saw a man in blue jeans and a cowboy hat standing in the center of the street. He had been looking at two bicycles which sat there upside down with their wheels sticking up. There had been three, but the smallest, a candy pink little girl's bike, had fallen over in the strengthening wind. The wheels of the other two spun madly. Now this fellow looked up, saw the cruiser, waved hesitantly, then started toward them. The cop pulled his large, square head back in. He turned to look at Johnny, who understood at once that the guy out there couldn't have gotten a good look at this particular officer of the law. If he had, he would be running in the other direction right now. The cop's mouth had the sunken, infirm look of lips with no teeth to back them up, and blood ran from the corners in little streams. One of his eyes was a cauldron of gore. Except for an occasional gray flash from its swimming depths, it could have been a plucked socket. A shiny mat of blood covered the top half of his khaki shirt. "That's Billy Rancourt.
he confided happily. He cuts my hair. I've been looking for him. He lowered his voice to that register at which confidences are imparted and added, he drinks a bit. Then he faced front, dropped the transmission into drive, and floored the accelerator. The rumbling engine howled. The tires squalled. Johnny was thrown backward, yelling with surprise. The cruiser shot forward. Johnny reached out, hooked his fingers through the mesh, and hauled himself back to a sitting position. He saw the man in the jeans and cowboy hat, Big Ball's Billy Rancourt, just standing there in the street, 10 feet or so in front of the bikes, frozen, watching them come. He seemed to swell in the windshield as the cruiser ran at him. It was like watching some crazy camera trick. No! Johnny shrieked, beating his left hand at the mesh behind the cop's head. No! Don't! Don't! Mister, look out! At the last minute, Billy Rancourt understood and tried to run. He broke to his right, toward a ramshackle house squatting tiredly behind a picket fence, but it was too little and too late. He yelled, and then there was a crump as the cruiser struck him hard enough to make the frame shudder. Blood spattered the picket fence. There was a double thud from beneath the car as the wheels ran over the fallen man, and then the cruiser hit the fence and knocked it down. The big cop jammed on the brakes, bringing the cruiser to a stop in the bald dirt dooryard of the ramshackle house. Johnny was thrown forward into the mesh again, but this time he managed to get his arm up and his head down, protecting his nose. "Billy, you bugger!" the cop cried happily. "Takala!" Billy Rancourt screamed. Johnny turned in the back seat of the cruiser and saw him crawling as fast as he could toward the north side of the street. That wasn't very fast. He was trailing a broken leg. There were tread marks running across the back of his shirt and the seat of his jeans. His cowboy hat was sitting on the pavement, now turned upside down like the bicycle's. Billy Rancourt bumped it with one knee, knocking at a slant, and blood poured out over the brim like water. More blood was gushing from his split skull and broken face. He was badly hurt, but although he had been struck amidships and then run over, he didn't appear even close to dead. That didn't surprise Johnny much. Most times, it took a lot to kill a man. He had seen it again and again in Vietnam. Guys alive with half their heads blown off. Guys alive with their guts piled in their laps and drawing flies. Guys alive with their jugulars spouting through their dirty fingers. People usually died hard. That was the horror of it. "Yee-haw!" the cop yelled and dropped the cruiser's transmission into reverse. The tires screamed and smoked across the sidewalk, bounced back into the street, and ran over Billy Rancourt's cowboy hat. The cruiser's back deck hit one of the bikes. It made a hell of a bang, cracked the rear window, and then flew out of sight for a moment before coming down in front. Johnny had time to see that Billy Rancourt had stopped crawling, that he was looking back over his shoulder at them, that his blood-streaked, broken-nosed face wore an expression of unspeakable resignation. He can't even be 30, Johnny thought, and then the man was born under the reversing car. It lurched over the body and came to a stop, idling against the far curb. The cop hit the horn with the point of his elbow, making it blip briefly, as he turned to face forward again. Ahead of the cruiser's nose, Billy Rancourt lay face down in a huge splat of blood. One of his feet twitched, then stopped. "Whoa," the cop said. "What a damn mess, huh?" "Yeah, you killed him," Johnny said. Suddenly he didn't care anymore about playing this guy up, outlasting him. He didn't care about the book, or his Harley, or where Steve Ames might be. Maybe later, if there was a later, he would care about some of those things, but not now. Now, in his shock and dismay, an earlier draft of himself had come out from someplace inside, a pre-edited version of Johnny Merenville who didn't give a shit about the Pulitzer Prize or the National Book Award or fucking actresses with or without emeralds. Ran him over in the street like a damn rabbit. Brave boy. The cop turned, gave him a considering look with his one good eye, then turned back to face the windshield again. I have taught thee in the way of wisdom, he said. I have led thee in the right paths. When thou goest, thy steps shall not be straightened, and when thou runnest, thou shalt not stumble. That's from the Book of Adverbs, John. But I think old Billy stumbled. Yes, I do. He was always a gluefoot. I think that was his basic problem. Johnny opened his mouth. For one of the few times in his entire life, nothing came out. Maybe that was just as well. Take fast hold of instruction. Let her not go. Keep her, for she is thy life. That's a little advice you could afford to take, Mr. Merenville, sir. Excuse me a minute. He got out and walked to the dead man in the street, his boots seeming to shimmer as the strengthening wind blew sand across them. There was a large bloody patch on the seat of his uniform pants now, and when he bent to pick up the late Billy Rancourt, Johnny saw more blood oozing out through the ripped seams under the cop's arms. It was as if he were literally sweating blood. Maybe so. Probably so. I think he's on the verge of crashing and bleeding out the way hemophiliacs sometimes do. If he wasn't so christing big, he'd probably be dead already. You know what you have to do, don't you? Yes, of course he did. He had a bad temper, a horrible temper, and it seemed that not even getting the shit kicked out of him by a homicidal maniac had changed that. What he had to do now was keep that temper of his under control. No more cracks, like calling the cop a brave boy just now. That had earned him a look Johnny hadn't liked at all. A dangerous look. The cop carried Billy Rancourt's body across the street, stepping between the two fallen bikes and past the one with its wheel still whirring and its spokes shining in the evening light. He tromped over the knocked-down piece of picket fence, climbed the steps of the house behind it, and shifted his burden so he could try the door. It opened with no trouble. Johnny wasn't surprised. He supposed that people out here did not, as a rule, bother locking their doors. He'll have to kill the people inside, he thought. That's pretty much automatic. But the cop only bent, offloaded his burden, then backed out onto the porch's little stoop again. He closed the door and then wiped his hands above it, leaving smears of blood on the lintel. He was so tall he didn't even have to reach to do this. The gesture gave Johnny a deep chill. It was like something out of the Book of Exodus, instructions for the angel of death to pass on by. Except this man was the angel of death, the destroyer. The cop walked back to the cruiser, got in, and drove sedately back toward the intersection. "Why'd you take him into there?" Johnny asked. "What did you want me to do?" the cop asked. His voice was thicker than ever. He seemed almost to be gargling his words. "Leave him for the buzzards? I'm ashamed of you, mon capitaine. You've been living so long with so-called civilized folk that you're starting to think like them." "The dog?" "A man is not a dog," the cop said in a prim, lecturely voice. He turned right at the intersection, then almost immediately hung a left, turning into a parking lot next to the town's municipal building. He killed the engine, got out, and opened the right-hand rear door. That at least spared Johnny the pain and effort of sliding his banged-up body out past the sagging driver's seat. "A chicken is not a chicken dinner, and a man is not a dog, Johnny. Not even a man like you. Come on, get out. Alley-zoop." Johnny got out. He was very aware of the silence. The sounds he could hear, wind, the spick-spack of alkali hitting the brick side of the municipal building, a monotonous squeaking sound from somewhere nearby, only emphasized that silence, turned it into something like a dome. He stretched, wincing at the pain in his back and leg, but needing to do something for the rest of his muscles, which were badly cramped. Then he forced himself to look up into the ruin of the cop's face. The man's height was intimidating, somehow disorienting. It wasn't just that at 6'3", Johnny was used to looking down into people's faces instead of up. It was the amount of the height differential, not an inch or two, but at least four. Then there was the breadth of the man, the sheer breadth. He didn't just stand, he loomed. "Why didn't you kill me like you did that guy back there, Billy? Or does it even make any sense to ask, are you beyond why?" "Oh, shit, we're all beyond why, you know that," the cop said, exposing bloody teeth and a smile Johnny could have done without. "The important thing is, listen closely, I can let you go. Would you like that? You must have at least two more stupid, pointless books left in your head. Maybe as many as half a dozen. You could write a few before that thunderclap coronary that's waiting for you up the road finally takes you off. And I'm sure that, given time, you could put this interlude behind you and once more convince yourself that what you are doing somehow justifies your existence. Would you like that, Johnny? Would you like me to let you go free?" Aaron Gobra, Johnny thought, for no reason at all, and for one nightmarish moment felt he would laugh. Then the urge was gone, and he nodded. "Yes, I'd like that very much." "Free! Like a bird out of a cage!" The cop flapped his arms to demonstrate, and Johnny saw that the bloody patches under his arms had spread. His uniform shirt was now stained crimson along the torn side seams almost all the way down to his belt line. Yes. Not that he believed his new playmate had the slightest intention in the world of letting him free. Oh, no. But said playmate was shortly going to be nothing but blood sausage held together by the casing of his uniform, and if he could just remain whole and functional himself until that happened. "All right. Here's the deal, big shot. Suck my cock. Do that and I'll let you go. Straight trade." He unzipped his fly and pulled down the elastic front of his shorts. Something that looked like a dead white snake fell out. Johnny observed the thin stream of blood drizzling from it without surprise. The cop was bleeding from every other orifice, wasn't he? "Speaking in the literary sense," the cop said, grinning, "this particular blowjob is going to be a little more Anne Rice than Armistead Maupin. I suggest you follow Queen Victoria's advice. Close your eyes and think of strawberry shortcake." Johnny Marinville looked at the maniac's prick, then up at the maniac's grinning face, then back at his prick again. He didn't know what the cop expected. Screams, revulsion, tears, melodramatic pleading. But he had a clear sense that he wasn't feeling what the cop wanted him to feel, what the cop probably thought he was feeling. "You don't seem to understand that I've seen a few worse things in my time than a cock dripping blood, not just in Vietnam either." He realized that the anger was creeping up on him again, threatening to take him over. Oh, shit, of course it was. Anger had always been his primary addiction, not whiskey or coke or lewds. Plain old rage. It didn't have anything to do with what the cop had taken out of his pants, and that might be what the guy didn't understand. It wasn't a sex issue. The thing was, Johnny Marinville had never liked anything stuck in his face. "I'll get down on my knees in front of you if you want," he said, and although his voice was mild, something in the cop's face changed, really changed, for the first time. It blanked out somehow, except for the good eye, which narrowed suspiciously. "Why are you looking at me that way? What in the hell gives you the right to look at me that way? Tack!" "Never mind how I'm looking at you. Just hear me out, motherfucker. 3 seconds after I put that trouser rat of yours into my mouth, it's going to be lying on the pavement. You got that? Tack!" He spat this last word up into the cop's face, standing on tiptoe to do it. And for a moment, the big man looked more than surprised. He looked shocked. Then the expression tightened into a cramp of rage, and he shoved Johnny away from him so hard that for a moment he felt as if he were flying. He hit the side of the building, saw stars as the back of his head connected with rough brick, bounced back, then went sprawling when his feet tangled together. New places hurt and old places howled, but the expression he had seen on the cop's face made it all worthwhile. He looked up to see if it was still there, wanting to sample it again like a bee sampling the sweetheart of a flower, and his heart staggered in his chest. The cop's face had tautened. The skin on it now looked like makeup or a thin coat of paint. Unreal. Even the blood-filled eye looked unreal. It was as if there was another face beneath the one Johnny could see, pushing at the overlying flesh, trying to get out. The cop's good eye fixed on him for a moment, and then his head lifted. He pointed at the sky with all five fingers of his left hand. "Tak Allah," he said in his guttural, gargling voice. "Timo, candy latch, on, on." There was a flapping sound like clothes on a line, and a shadow fell over Johnny's face. There was a harsh cry, not quite a caw, and then something with scabrous, flapping wings dropped on him, its crooked claws gripping his shoulders and folding themselves into the fabric of his shirt, its beak digging into his scalp as it uttered its inhuman cry again. It was the smell that told Johnny what it was, a smell like meat gone feverish with rot. Its huge, unkempt wings flapped against the sides of his face as it solidified its position, driving that stench into his mouth and nose, jamming it in, making him gag. He saw the shepherd on its rope, swinging as the peeled-looking bald things pulled at its tail and feet with their beaks. Now one of them was roosting on him, one which had apparently never heard that buzzards were fundamental cowards that only attacked dead things, and its beak was plowing his scalp in furrows, bringing blood. "Get it off!" he screamed, completely unnerved. He tried to grab the wide, beating wings, but got only two fistfuls of feathers. Nor could he see. He was afraid that if he opened his eyes, the buzzard would shift its position and peck them out. "Jesus, please, please get it off me!" "Are you going to look at me properly if I do?" the cop asked. "No more insolence? No more disrespect?" "No, no more!" He would have promised anything. Whatever had leaped out of him and spoken against the cop was gone now. The bird had plucked it out like a worm from an ear of corn. "You promise?" The bird, flapping and squalling and pulling, smelling like green meat and exploded guts, on him, eating him alive. "Yes, yes, I promise." "Fuck you," the cop said calmly. "Fuck you, Ozpa, and fuck your promise. Take care of it yourself, or die." Eyes squeezed to slits. Kneeling, head lowered, Johnny gripped blindly for the bird, caught its wings where they joined its body, and tore it off his head. It spasmed wildly in the air above him, shitting white streams that the wind pulled away in banners, uttering its rough cry, only there was pain in it now, its head whipping from side to side. Sobbing, mostly what he felt was revulsion, Johnny ripped one of its wings off and threw the buzzard against the wall. It stared at him with eyes as black as tar, its blood-stained beak popping open and then snapping closed with liquid little clicks. "That's my blood, you bastard," Johnny thought. He dropped the wing he'd torn off the bird and got to his feet. The buzzard tried to lurch away from him, flapping its one good wing like an oar, stirring up dust and feathers. It went in the direction of the desperation police cruiser, but before it managed more than 5 feet, Johnny brought one motorcycle boot down on it, snapping its back. The bird's scaly legs splayed out to either side, as if it were trying to do the split. Johnny put his hands over his eyes, convinced for one moment that his mind was going to snap just as the bird's back had snapped.
"Not bad," the cop said. "You got him, Pard. Now turn around."
"No." He stood, trembling all over, hands to his face.
"Turn around."
There was no denying the voice. He turned and saw the cop pointing up, once again with all five splayed fingers. Johnny raised his head and saw more buzzards, 2 dozen at least, sitting in a line along the north side of the parking lot, looking down at them.
"Want me to call them?"
the cop asked in a deceptively gentle tone of voice.
"I can, you know.
Birds are a hobby of mine."
"They'll eat you alive, if that's what I want."
No. He looked back at the cop and was relieved to see his fly was zipped again. There was a bloodstain spreading across the front of his pants, though.
"No. Don't."
"What's the magic word, Johnny?"
For a moment, a horrible moment, he had no idea what the cop wanted him to say. Then it came to him.
"Please."
"Are you ready to be reasonable?"
Yes.
"I wonder about that," the cop said. He seemed to be speaking to himself.
"I just wonder." Johnny stood looking at him, saying nothing. The anger was gone. Everything felt gone, replaced by a kind of deep numbness.
"That boy," the cop said, looking up toward the second floor of the municipal building, where there were a number of opaque windows with bars outside them. "That boy troubles my mind. I wonder if I shouldn't talk to you about him. Perhaps you could counsel me."
The cop folded his arms against his body, raised his hands, and began to tap his fingers lightly against his collarbones, much as he'd tapped them against the steering wheel earlier. He stared at Johnny as he did this.
"Or maybe I should just kill you, Johnny. Maybe that would be the best thing. Once you're dead, they might award you that Nobel you've always lusted after. What do you think?"
The cop raised his head to the buzzard-lined roofline of the municipal building and began to laugh. They cried harsh, cawing sounds back down to him, and Johnny was not able to stifle the thought which came to him then. It was horrible because it was so convincing. They are laughing with him, because it's not his joke. It's their joke. A gust of air snapped across the parking lot, making Johnny stagger on his feet, blowing the torn-off buzzard wing across the pavement like a feather duster. The light was fading out of the day, fading too fast. He looked to the west and saw that rising dust had blurred the mountains in that direction and might soon erase them completely. The sun was still above the dust, but wouldn't be for long. It was a windstorm and headed their way.
5.
The five people in the holding cells, the Carvers, Mary Jackson, and old Mr. Whitehair, listened to the man screaming and to the sounds that accompanied the screams, harsh bird cries and flapping wings. At last they stopped. David hoped no one else was dead down there, but when you got right down to it, what were the chances?
"What did you say his name was?" Mary asked.
"Collie Antragian," the old man said.
He sounded as if listening to the screams had pretty much tired him out.
"Collie's short for Collier. He come here from one of those mining towns in Wyoming, 15, 16 years ago. Little more than a teenager then he was. Wanted police work. Couldn't get it. Went to work for the Diablo Company up to the pit instead. That was around the time Diablo was getting ready to pack up and go home. Collie was part of the close-down crew, as I remember."
"He told Peter and me the mine was open," Mary said. The old man shook his head in what might have been weariness or exasperation.
"There's some thinks old China ain't played out, but they're wrong. It's true they've been bustling around up there again, but they won't take Doonley Squad out of it. Just lose their investors' money and then shut her down. Won't be nobody any happier about it than Jim Reed, either. He's tired of barroom fights. All of us'll be glad when they leave old China alone again. It's haunted. That's what the ignorant folks around these parts think. He paused. I'm one of them.
Who's Jim Reed? Ralph asked.
Town safety officer. What you'd call chief of police in a bigger burg, but there's only 200 or so people in Desperation these days. Jim had two full-time deputies, Dave Pearson and Collie. Nobody expected Collie to stay around after Diablo folded, but he did. He wasn't married, and he had workman's comp. He floated along for a while, odd-jobbing, and eventually Jim started to throw work his way. He was good enough so that the town officers took Jim's recommendation and hired him on full-time in 91.
Three guys seems like a lot of law for a town this small, Ralph said.
I reckon. But we got some money from Washington, Rural Law Enforcement Act, plus we landed a contract with Sedalia County to keep school on the unincorporated lands round here. Pop the speeders, jug the drunks, all such as that.
More coyote wails from outside. They sounded shimmery in the rising wind. Mary asked, what did he get workman's comp for? Some kind of mental problem?
No. Pickup he was riding in turned turtle on its way down into the pit yonder. The China. Just before the Diablo people gave it up as a bad job, this was. Blew out his knee. Boy was fit enough after, but he had a limp. No question about that.
Then it's not him, Mary said flatly. The old man looked at her, shaggy eyebrows raised. The man who killed my husband does not limp.
No, the old man agreed.
He spoke with a weird kind of serenity.
No, he don't. But it's Collie, all right. I've been seeing him most every day for 15 years. Have bought him drinks and the broken drum and had him buy me a few in return over at Bud's Suds. He was the one who came to the clinic, took pictures and dusted for prints the time those fellows broke in. Probably looking for drugs they were, but I don't know. They never caught him.
Are you a doctor, mister? David asked.
Vet, the old man said. Tom Billingsley's my name.
He held out a big, worn hand that shook a little. David took it gingerly.
Downstairs, a door smashed open. Here we are, Big John, the cop said. His voice rolled jovially up the stairs. Your room awaits. Room? Hell, a regular efficiency apartment. Up you go. We forgot the word processor, but we left you some great walls and a few little hallmark sentiments like suck my cock and I fucked your sister to get you started.
Tom Billingsley glanced toward the door which gave upon the stairs, then looked back at David. He spoke loud enough for the others to hear, but it was David he looked at. David he seemed to want to tell.
Tell you something else, he said. He's bigger.
What do you mean?
But David thought he knew. What I said. Collie was never a midget, stood about 6'4", I'd judge, and probably weighed about 230. But now...
He glanced toward the doorway to the stairs again. Toward the sound of approaching, clumping footsteps. Two sets. Then he looked back at David.
Now I'd say he's at least 3 inches more than that, wouldn't you? And maybe 60 pounds heavier.
That's crazy, Ellen cried. Absolutely nuts.
Yes'm, the white-haired vet agreed. But it's true.
The door to the stairs flew all the way open. And a man with a bloody face and shoulder-length gray hair, it was also streaked and clumped with blood, flew into the room. He didn't cross it with Mary Jackson's balletic grace, but stumbled at the halfway point and fell to his knees, holding his hands out in front of him to keep from crashing into the desk. The man who followed him through the door was the man who had brought them all to this place, and yet he wasn't. He was a kind of blood gorgon. A creature who appeared to be disintegrating before their very eyes. He surveyed them from the melting ramparts of his face, and his mouth spread in a wide, lip-splitting grin. Look at us,
he said in a thick, sentimental voice. Look at us, would you? Gosh, just one big, happy family. Part 2. Desperation. In these silences, something may rise. Chapter 1. 1. Steve?
What?
Is that what I think it is? She was pointing out her window, pointing west.
What do you think it is?
Sand, she said. Sand and wind.
Yep, I'd say that's what it is.
Pull over a minute, would you? He looked at her, questioning. Just for a minute. Steve Ames pulled the Ryder van over to the side of the road, which led south from Highway 50 to the town of Desperation. They had found it with no trouble at all. Now he sat behind the wheel and looked at Cynthia Smith, who had tickled him even in his unease by calling him her nice new friend. She wasn't looking at her nice new friend now. She was looking down at the bottom of her funky Peter Tosh shirt and plucking at it nervously. I'm a hard-headed babe, she said without looking up. A little psychic, but hard-headed just the same. Do you believe that?
I guess.
And practical. Do you believe that?
Sure.
That's why I made fun of your intuition or whatever. But you thought we'd find something out there by the road, and we did.
Yes, we did.
So it was a good intuition.
Would you get to the point? My boss.
Right. Your boss, your boss, your boss. I know that's what you're thinking about, and practically all you're thinking about. And that's what's got me worried. Because I have a bad feeling about this, Steve. A bad intuition. He looked at her. Slowly, reluctantly, she raised her head and looked back at him. What he saw in her eyes startled him badly. It was the flat shine of fear.
What is it? What are you afraid of?
I don't know.
Look, Cynthia, all we're going to do is find a cop, lacking that a phone booth, and report Johnny missing. Also, a bunch of people named Carver.
Just the same.
Don't worry. I'll be careful. Promise.
Would you try 911 on your cellular again? She asked this in a small, meek voice that was not much like her usual one. He did, to please her, expecting nothing, and nothing was what he got. Not even a recording this time. He didn't know for sure, but he thought the oncoming windstorm, or dust storm, or whatever they call them out here, might be screwing things up even worse.
Sorry, no go, he said. Want to try it yourself? You might have better luck, the woman's touch and all that.
She shook her head. Do you feel anything? Anything at all? He sighed. Yes, he felt something. It reminded him of the way he had sometimes felt in early puberty back in Texas. The summer he had turned 13 had been the longest, sweetest, strangest summer of his life. Toward the end of August, evening thunderstorms had often moved through the area, brief but hellacious convulsions the old cowboys called benders. And in that year, a year when it seemed that every other pop song on the radio was by the Bee Gees, the hushed minutes before these storms, black sky, still air, sharpening thunder, lightning jabbing at the prairie like forks into tough meat, had somehow turned him on in a way he had never experienced since. His eyes felt like globes of electricity in chrome sockets. His stomach rolled, his penis filled with blood and stood up hard as a skillet handle. A feeling of terrified ecstasy came in those hushes, a sense that the world was about to give up some great secret, to play it like a special card. In the end, of course, there had never been a revelation, unless his discovery of how to masturbate a year or so later had been it. Only rain. That was how he felt now, only there was no hard-on, no tingling arm hairs, no ecstasy, and no sense of terror, not really.
What he had been feeling ever since she had uncovered the boss's motorcycle helmet was a sense of low foreboding, a sense that things had gone wrong and would soon go wronger. Until she had spoken up just now, he'd pretty much written that feeling off. As a kid, he'd probably just been responding to changes in the air pressure as the storm approached, or electricity in the air, or some other damn thing. And a storm was coming now, wasn't it? Yes. So it was probably the same thing, deja vu all over again, as they said, perfectly understandable. Yet... Yeah, okay. I do feel something. But what in the hell can I do about it? You don't want me to turn back, do you? No, we can't do that. Just be careful, okay? A gust of wind shook the rider truck. A cloud of tawny sand blew across the road, turning it into a momentary mirage. Okay, but you've got to help. He got the truck moving again. The setting sun had touched the rising membrane of sand in the west now, and its bottom arc had gone as red as blood. Oh, yeah, she said, grimacing as a fresh blast of wind hit the truck. You can count on that. 2. The blood-soaked cop locked the newcomer into the cell next to David Carver and Tom Billingsley. That done, he turned slowly on his heels in a complete circle, his half-peeled, bleeding face solemn and contemplative. Then he reached into his pocket and brought out the key ring again. He selected the same one as before, David noticed. Square, with a black mag strip on it, so it was probably a master. "Eeny, meeny, miny, moe," he said. "Catch a tourist by the toe." He walked toward the cell which held David's mother and father. As he approached, they drew back, arms around each other again. "You leave them alone!" David cried, alarmed. Billingsley took his arm above the elbow, but David shook it off. "Do you hear me? Leave them alone!" "In your dreams, brat," Conley and Trajan said. He poked the key into the cell's lock, and there was a little thump as the tumblers turned. He pulled the door open. "Good news, Ellie. Your parole came through. Pop on out here." Ellie shook her head. Shadows had begun to gather in the holding area now, and her face swam in them, pale as paper. Ralph put his other arm around her waist and drew her back even farther. "Haven't you done enough to our family?" he asked. "In a word, no." And Trajan drew his cannon-sized gun, pointed it at Ralph, and cocked it. "You come out of here right now, little lady, or I'll shoot this no-chin pecker-checker spang between the eyes. You want his brains in his head or drying on the wall? It's all the same to me, either way." "God, make him quit it," David prayed. "Please make him quit it. If you could bring Brian back from wherever he was, you can do that. You can make him quit it. Dear God, please don't let him take my mother." Ellie was pushing Ralph's hands down, pushing them off her. "Ellie, no!" "I have to. Don't you see that?" Ralph let his hands fall to his sides. And Trajan dropped the hammer on his gun and slid it back into his holster. He held one hand out to Ellen, as if inviting her to take a spin on the dance floor. And she went to him. When she spoke, her voice was very low. David knew she was saying something she didn't want him to hear, but his ears were very good. "If you want that, take me where my son won't have to see." "Don't worry," Entragian said in that same low conspirator's voice. "I don't want that. Especially not from you. Now come on." He slammed the cell door shut, giving it a little shake to make sure it was locked, while he held on to David's mother with the other hand. Then he led her toward the door. "Mom!" David screamed. He seized the bars and shook them. The cell door rattled a little, but that was all. "Mom, no! Leave her alone, you bastard! Leave my mother alone!" "Don't worry, David. I'll be back," she said, but the soft, almost uninflected quality of her voice scared him badly. It was as if she were already gone, or as if the cop had hypnotized her just by touching her. "Don't worry about me."
"No!" David screamed. "Daddy, make him stop! Make him stop!"
In his heart was a growing certainty. If the huge, bloody cop took his mother out of this room, they would never see her again.
"David."
Ralph took two blundering steps backward, sat on the bunk, put his hands over his face, and began to cry.
"I'll take care of her, Dave. Don't worry," Antragian said.
He was standing by the door to the stairs and holding Ellen Carver's arm above the elbow. He wore a grin that would have been resplendent if not for his blood-streaked teeth.
"I'm sensitive. A real Bridges of Madison County kind of guy, only without the cameras."
"If you hurt her, you'll be sorry," David said. The cop's smile faded. He looked both angry and a little hurt.
"Perhaps I will, but I doubt it. I really do. You're a little prey boy, aren't you?"
David looked at him steadily, saying nothing.
"Yes? Yes, you are. You've just got that prey boy look about you. Great gosh almighty eyes and a real jeepers creepers mouth. A little prey boy in a baseball shirt. Gosh!"
He put his head close to Ellen's and looked slyly at the boy through the gauze of her hair.
"Do all the praying you want, David, but don't expect it to do you any help. Your God isn't here, any more than he was with Jesus when Jesus hung dying on the cross with flies in his eyes. Tack!"
Ellen saw it coming up the stairs. She screamed and tried to pull back, but Antragian held her where she was. The coyote oiled through the doorway. It didn't even look at the screaming woman with her arm pinched in the cop's fist, but crossed calmly to the center of the room. Then it stopped, turned its head over one shoulder, and fixed its yellow, stuffed animal stare on Antragian.
"Allah,"
he said, and let go of Ellen's arm long enough to spank his right hand across the back of his left hand in a quick gesture that reminded David of a flat stone skipping across the surface of a pond. "Him and toe." The coyote sat down.
"This guy is fast," Antragian said.
He was apparently speaking to them all, but it was David he was looking at.
"I mean, the guy is fast. Faster than most dogs. You stick a hand or foot out of your cell, he'll have it off before you know it's gone. I guarantee that."
"You leave my mother alone," David said.
"Son," Antragian said regretfully, "I'll put a stick up your mother's twat and spin her until she catches fire if I so decide, and you'll not stop me. And I'll be back for you."
He went out the door, pulling David's mother with him. 3. There was silence in the room, broken only by Ralph Carver's choked sobs and the coyote, which sat panting and regarding David with its unpleasantly intelligent eyes. Little drops of spittle fell from the end of its tongue like drops from a leaky pipe.
"Take heart, son," the man with the shoulder-length gray hair said. He sounded like a guy more used to taking comfort than giving it. "You saw him. He's got internal bleeding. He's losing his teeth. One eye's ruptured right out of his head. He can't last much longer."
"It won't take him long to kill my mom if he decides to," David said. "He already killed my little sister. He pushed her down the stairs and broke her neck.
His eyes abruptly blurred with tears, and he willed them back. This was no time to get bawling.
"Yes, but..." The gray-haired man trailed off. David found himself remembering an exchange with the cop when they had been on their way to this town, when they had still thought the cop was sane and normal and only helping them out. He had asked the cop how he knew their name, and the cop had said he'd read it on the plaque over the table. It was a good answer. There was a plaque with their name on it over the table. But Antragian never would have been able to see it from where he was standing at the foot of their RV stairs.
I've got eagle eyes, David, he'd said, and those are eyes that see the truth from afar.
Ralph Carver came slowly forward to the front of his cell again, almost shuffling. His eyes were bloodshot, the lids puffy, his face ravaged. For a moment, David felt almost blinded with rage, shaken by a desire to scream, "This is all your fault. Your fault that Pye's dead. Your fault that he's taken Mom off to kill her or rape her. You and your gambling. You and your stupid vacation ideas. He should have taken you, Dad. He should have taken you."
"Stop it, David." His thought, Gene Martin's voice. "That's just the way it wants you to think."
It? The cop and Trajan. Was that who the voice meant by it? And what way did he, or it, want him to think? For that matter, why would it care what way he thought at all?
"Look at that thing," Ralph said, staring at the coyote. "How could he call it in here like that? And why does it stay?"
The coyote turned toward Ralph's voice, then glanced at Mary, then looked back at David. It panted. More saliva fell to the hardwood floor, where a little puddle was forming.
"He's got them trained somehow," the gray-haired man said. "Like the birds. He's got some trained buzzards out there. I killed one of the scraggy bastards. I stomped it."
"No," Mary said.
"No," Billingsley echoed. "I'm sure that coyotes can be trained, but this is not training."
"Of course it is," the gray-haired man snapped.
"That cop," David said, "Mr. Billingsley says he's taller than he used to be, 3 inches at least."
"That's insane." The gray-haired man was wearing a motorcycle jacket. Now he unzipped one of the pockets, took out a battered roll of lifesavers, and put one in his mouth.
"Sir, what's your name?" Ralph asked the gray-haired man.
"Marinville. Johnny Marinville. I'm a..."
"What you are is blind if you can't see that something very terrible and very out of the ordinary is going on here."
"I didn't say it wasn't terrible, and I certainly didn't say it was ordinary," the gray-haired man replied. He went on, but then the voice came again, the outside voice, and David lost track of their conversation.
"The soap, David. The soap." He looked at it, a green bar of Irish Spring sitting beside the spigot, and thought of Entragian saying, "I'll be back for you." The soap. Suddenly he understood, or thought he did, hoped he did. "I better be right. I better be right, or..." He was wearing a Cleveland Indians T-shirt. He pulled it off, dropped it by the cell door. He looked up and saw the coyote staring at him. Its ragged ears were all the way up again, and David thought he could hear it growling, low and far back in its throat.
"Son," his father asked, "what do you think you're doing?"
Without answering, he sat down on the end of the bunk, took off his sneakers, and tossed them over to where his shirt lay. Now there was no question that the coyote was growling, as if it knew what he was planning to do. As if it meant to stop him if he actually tried it.
"Don't be a dope. Of course it means to stop you if you try it. Why else did the cop leave it there? You just have to trust. Trust and have faith."
"Have faith that God will protect me," he murmured. He stood up, unbuckled his belt, then paused with his fingers on the snap of his jeans.
"Ma'am," he said. "Ma'am."
She looked at him, and David felt himself blush. "I wonder if you'd mind turning around," he said. "I have to take off my pants, and I guess I better take off my underwear, too."
"What in God's name are you thinking about?" his father asked. There was panic in his voice now. "Whatever it is, I forbid it. Absolutely."
David didn't reply, only looked at Mary. Looked at her as steadily as the coyote was looking at him. She returned his look for a moment, then, without saying a word, turned her back. The man in the motorcycle jacket sat on his bunk, crunching his lifesaver and watching him. David was as body shy as most 11-year-olds, and that steady gaze made him uncomfortable. But, As he had already pointed out to himself, this was no time to be a dope. He took another glance at the bar of Irish Spring, then thumbed down his pants and undershorts. 4.
Nice, Cynthia said.